San Francisco's, and some might find the subject of this next interview distressing, San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge has the unenviable reputation of being a favoured place for suicide, hundreds, since it opened in 1937. Now a multi-million dollar safety net is being built around the bridge to try to prevent people from jumping off it. Kevin Briggs spent over 20 years as a highway patrol in California, highway patrolman, and was involved in hundreds of suicide calls from the bridge. Of the incidents he was directly involved with, only two people actually went on to jump to their deaths. He retired in 2013. And now his message is that suicide is preventable. He wrote a book called Guardian of Golden Gate Bridge, and he offers training and consultation for organisations. He's an advocate for suicide prevention. Meanwhile, the safety net around the bridge is expected to be completed in 2021. Interestingly enough, he is not entirely in favour of it.
You know, I wasn't, and it's, I know it's going to save lives, but could we have done other things with the money, over $200 million? You know, there's controversy about it. It is for a good thing. It is going to save lives on the bridge, but the bridge isn't the only place where suicides are occurring.
So what are you suggesting, that people might just go elsewhere?
Yes. You know, it will deter some folks, but, you know, there's other bridges in the Bay Area, and there's other means, so.
And so the people who wanted the barrier were the families of people who had suicided from the bridge. Do you think that they will be happy at the end of it? I mean, how is it something that they needed to do, but you would rather, as you've said, see the money spent elsewhere?
And I say this because I have not lost a family member from that bridge, and I can definitely see where they're coming from. And I think it is a very good idea, because most of the suicides which occur on bridges in the Bay Area are definitely from that particular bridge. And like I said, if I had lost a family member, boy, I'd be right on top of them wanting a barrier. But to take that back and look at suicides as a whole, I think we have a lot of other things that we could look at also.
And you're talking about mental health.
Yes. Suicide prevention and getting out and speaking with folks. So I think there's a lot of work to be done still. It is, I think it's getting better, even though suicide numbers are still increasing in America. I think the stigma is reducing or being reduced. And I think we are doing better, but I think we still have a lot of work to do.
How do you work that out? I mean, the stigma may be being reduced, but if the numbers are still going up, how's that a good thing?
That's because we have more and more people.
Yeah.
You know, every year. But I think because we're able to talk about it, and we're getting into schools now where these things start, and talking to kids and tell them it's okay to talk about your feelings and what's going on. And they say it's okay not to feel okay. That's all right. So as a whole, I think we are going to get better. I think as the years go by and it becomes more and more evident that we can talk about it and it's okay to talk about these things, your mental health and behavioral health, that it's going to improve.
Did you talk about your own? I mean, this must have taken a terrible toll on you all those years, having to deal with other people's pain and crises. Did you talk about how you felt about it?
I didn't for a long time, because as an officer, you just don't. You do your job, you go home, you come back the next day and you do the same thing. But what it does is it starts to build on you, and the PTSD and the things that you see and you do and you hear, you know, it can take a toll on you. And I think it does for every law enforcement officer or first responder out there.
So when did you first start realizing the toll it was taking on you? How did that manifest itself?
What I found out was I go to work and be fine. Everything's great. But when I went home is when I just didn't want to do a thing. When I didn't have to be at work, I pretty much just stayed at my house. I didn't want to go out. I didn't want to ride the bicycle. I didn't want to play with my boys, walk the dog. So that's when depression would really take a toll on me, when I didn't have to go out and do this job.
And what did you do about that?
So it was some time. I suffered for quite some time. I didn't realize this until I finally went to my doctor and I told him, I think life's kind of passing me up. I don't know what's going on. How is it that someone can go to work and be great and everything's fine, but go home and do nothing and just sit there? So he diagnosed me with depression and thought some medication might help. I wish it did. And I went for a while with that and things were okay. But there were things that I still needed to talk about. So it was quite some time later before I went to a psychiatrist, which recommended another clinician to me. And I went through some eye movement desensitization for trauma. And it really, really helped. But mind you, I had these kind of macho jobs where we didn't show a weakness, really weren't allowed to show a weakness. I was in the Army right out of high school, and then I worked in corrections for 3 years. I worked San Quentin State Prison and then the California Highway Patrol. So it was very, very hard for me to open up. But once I did, and I went into things with an open mind, that's when things started to turn around for me and become better. And that includes things like meditation, and being able to relax.
I want to talk a bit more about how ironic it is that you were dealing with all these crises of other people and dealing with them so well and effectively, but not attending to yourself. Can you just tell me what eye movement desensitization is? Because I've heard somebody else talk about it recently.
Yes, basically, you work with a mental health professional, and she would talk about things and bring up things that I had told her that it had occurred to me and this trauma. And what happened with me was there is a man's face that was always, when I was trying to sleep at night, about 2 inches away from me, and it would just be there hovering and would haunt me every single night. And I told her this, and we talked about it for a while. And she says, I cannot take that trauma away. But if we can make through this and break this barrier, I'm going to get it so that face is way out and it's very, very small. So we went through this through a long program, and it actually worked. And I just kept an open mind and kind of did what she said and went through therapy. And it does take some time, but it worked.
And what's the eye, what eye movement did you have to?
So I had these two paddles. I would hold a paddle in each hand, and then there would be like either a noise or the handle would kind of buzz, and I would click on it. And it's amazing because my eyes, even though I would close my eyes, she said you could have them open or closed, my eyes would follow the movement of the paddles. And whatever it does, I don't know all the science behind it, but it really worked. And it was something else.
How interesting. Back to the point I made earlier, you saved hundreds of people's lives by listening to them, by being there. You knew that they needed to talk, but you didn't realize that you also needed to talk.
Right, exactly. I became pretty good at listening. I'm still working on it, but many of us, we take things in and take it in and take it in, and we don't have an outlet for ourselves. So that's what I go out and I speak a lot about now is our own quality of life. How can we sustain a good quality of life for us? You may give, 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 give all day long, but what about you? What are you doing for you?
I think that your son also had, as a teenager, a crisis. There was self-harm going on. Were you able to attend to that fully?
We did, and I did not realize this. And here I am teaching active listening skills and suicide prevention and talking about all these different things. And it's happening at home, in front of me, at the house. And it was really, really something else. What an eye-opener. My poor boy, who was 14 at the time, he was actively suicidal and he was cutting himself. And I didn't realize this. And when I had first heard about it and I talked with him about it, it was just broke my heart. So we went to a mental health professional, And that's when we started this process of healing for him and for me. And I learned a hell of a lot. But I got to tell you, I really preach this and I try to do this in my own life. It starts with us and then our families, and then it goes out to everybody else. We really need to focus on taking care of ourselves and our families first.
What do you say to parents who might be missing their own children's pain and distress? How can they be more aware of it?
Active listening skills. Look that up. We hear these things all the time. Oh, I use all the active listening skills. But have you really had a class in it or looked it up and see what they are and what they're about? Do you really listen to what they're telling you? Whether you like it or not, you say, what's been going on in your life? Or not just the open-ended question of, well, how was everything today? And they say, fine, and that's case closed, good. Well, I guess they're good because they said they're fine. No, tell me about today or what's been going on, and take the time to listen. If we don't, we're going to lose kids, and that's exactly what's been going on. So we need to take the time to try to understand things at their level.
How long, on average, would you spend with an individual on the bridge who was wanting to jump?
Generally, it'd be anywhere from 20 minutes to the longest one I had was right around 8 hours. So on average, I would say between an hour and an hour and a half.
8 hours. What was going on?
That was a long one.
What was going on in those 8 hours?
He was a construction worker who was having a very, very difficult time. And he really contemplated life. He was amazing to talk to. He was not under the influence of anything. So the conversation that we had was really, really something. He talked about his family, and that's what I tried to focus on, more of his family and the love they have for him and how he loved his family and what would happen if he did jump. So it took a long time, and actually I worked with a Marin County Sheriff deputy on this, and we would kind of take turns at doing this, at speaking with this gentleman and giving him time to think. I'm a big believer in giving people the time to contemplate everything on their own, to take a step back and let them think about things. So we did a lot of that also.
And
but
he came back?
He actually came back.
Do you think, this is a rough kind of a question, but do you think that all those people that you persuaded back onto the bridge, do you think that many of them went on to suicide later?
There's studies that say no. I have not followed up with folks. So, out of the many that I spoke with and helped or attempted to help, I would hope not. I didn't follow up with the folks, so I would hope they're still here.
There's a very well-known case. Kevin Berthia, is that his name?
Yes.
Whom you brought back after an hour and a half. You brought him back onto the bridge. He now speaks out about suicide prevention. He's been very frank about his situation. Can you tell me about him, given that he's spoken out himself?
Sure. He and I are actually friends, and a couple of times a year we get to speak together on stage, and he's really neat. He's a lot of fun. So I did receive a call of a man who was actually standing on the sidewalk. Kevin was actually on the sidewalk at the beginning, and I rode a motorcycle for the highway patrol. So when I received this call, I started working my way down the sidewalk. As I neared the north tower is when I observed him. So I stopped around 50 feet or so away from him, and as I was getting off of my motorcycle, he looked my direction and he just jumped over the rail. And as he did, I yelled something at him. I can't remember what it was, but he reached out and he caught the rail and he swung around and he actually landed on a little bitty pipe that is below the pedestrian rail. That's miracle number one. I don't know how he was able to catch himself, but he did. I thought he was gone. So I ran up there and I saw his white t-shirt. And what I had learned to do through experiences such as these is I raise a hand and I show an open palm and I say, hey, my name's Kevin. Is it okay if I come and chat with you for a while? I want to get their permission. They can see I'm in a uniform. I'm some kind of authority figure. So I want to get their permission. and he wanted nothing to do with me. He kept yelling at me, "If you come one step closer, I'm jumping." And he just kept screaming that at me for some time. But it finally wore him down a little bit, and he began to trust me a bit. And he did allow me to come up and speak with him. And when he did, I tried to get below him for the majority of the time. I don't like to stand on the rail and look down at the folks, because I think that's what we're doing, is we're looking down at them. I want to be equal with our eyes, if at all possible. So we did that, and we were there for about an hour and a half. During this time, Kevin spoke the majority of the time. I spoke out of this whole encounter maybe 4, 5, 6 minutes. But he talked about everything in his past, and what really boiled down to was nobody had sat down and just listened to him. Everybody wanted to offer him advice. Well, have you done this, and have you tried this, and how come you didn't do this? But nobody just sat down and listened to this young guy. So that's all I did, was take it all in and not tell him what he should do or what he should have done, but just to be there for him. And that's all this guy was looking for, was this. So this is why I say, even though I've been through schools and learned these different techniques and all these different things, all it takes is for somebody who cares to have a good ear to sit and listen to someone.
After you've listened to these people, after you listened to Kevin, for example, what happened to them? Do they get help? Do you refer them on to somebody else when they come back onto the bridge?
So take Kevin, for instance. When he said, "I'm going to come back over," then I helped him. I don't slip at that time. I helped him back over the rail onto the sidewalk. I congratulated him. And then I asked him, like I do everyone, because I want to learn as we continue on with this. But I asked him, I go, "What did I do that helped this situation? And what did I do that wasn't so good that hurt this situation?" And all he told me was, "You listened. You let me speak, and you listened." That's what he was looking for. So at this point, I explained to him that I'm going to have to take you down to a local hospital for an evaluation to a mental health professional. And that's what we did. And then that started his process of getting better.
And so that would be what you would do with the people that you've brought back on the bridge. You would take them for a health assessment and get them to get some kind of help.
Exactly. One of the local hospitals for a mental health evaluation.
How many people would have been on drugs?
I would say a fair number. They look for drugs or for alcohol, that liquid courage, to complete this act. Because I think it takes a hell of a lot of courage to go over that rail. And I think if they're under the influence of drugs or alcohol, it helps them to do that. And then it hinders our process and their decision-making when we're trying to speak with them.
Mm. Interestingly, one of the things you say is, don't say, "I understand," or I know what you're going through. Why is that?
Exactly.
Why?
Because I don't know what they're going through. I've had some things in my life. I've had 3 heart surgeries. I've had cancer, some head injuries, and a lot of different things. But I've never been suicidal. And I think to go over that rail and stand on this little I-beam that's over there on the other side, yeah, it takes a hell of a lot of courage. But I think for me to go up and say, "I understand exactly what you're going through," in my opinion, it slaps people in the face and demeans them. Now, if they say, "Well, you don't know what it's like to have cancer." Well, I had cancer, and we can talk about that. And that does a whole lot of different things. It allows us to bond a little bit. They say commonalities create comfort. But we can talk about that. But nothing's ever that if my cancer is not going to be exactly the same as theirs or the drugs or the length of term or anything like that. But it gives us something to talk about. And that's what we're looking for in developing rapport. So I may understand a little bit of what they're going through, but not the exact thing. We're not, you know, none of us are that similar to where we can say, "I know exactly what you're going through."
Do you think that it's still an idea at large that it is weakness to attempt suicide?
You still hear that now and again, that that's a weak thing to do, a weak person, or you're selfish. But that's somebody who has not experienced Well, what I have, at least of talking to these folks who are actively suicidal, because I can tell you it takes a hell of a lot of courage to go over that rail and stand on the other side of that bridge. They are not, without courage. It mind boggles me to say these people are selfish. They are not selfish. All they want is their pain to end. They don't want to hurt their family members. This is not about revenge or hurting someone else. This is about them and the pain that they are in and the agony that they're in, and they're trying to cope with it. They think they've exhausted all means of coping with whatever is going on in their life, and this is it. They just can't see a tomorrow.
Is there a main age group or a demographic or a male, female breakdown?
Yes, well, on the bridge, it's generally white males. But overall, it's still white males. I believe it's 45 to 60 range.
Who
That's the typical
suicide?
one. Yes.
Right. Do you have any ideas why that might be?
I think as folks get older, especially today, when you go into businesses or you go into a big business, say Google or Twitter or anything like that, all you see is young people everywhere. And I think it's harder and harder for folks over 50 to find work. That's part of it. Or as you even get older, losing a spouse. Maybe you've been married 35 years and you lose a spouse, and that was such an integral part of your life. Maybe you're diagnosed now. As we get older, we get diagnosed with more illnesses. So I think a whole gamut of things.
There was a documentary a few years ago called The Bridge. I don't know what you thought of that.
It shows people jumping from the bridge, off the bridge. And I don't like that. Could you imagine filming your family member, your wife, your husband, your brother, your sister, somebody, your family member jumping from that bridge? I think it's horrible. As someone who has looked into the eyes of people who have both come back over the rail and those who have jumped, it breaks my heart to see that. I know there's folks who want to see this or are very, very curious, this morbid curiosity about seeing someone who jumps off the bridge. But as someone who has been there, kind of been there and done that, has seen these folks do this, it's terrible. And I don't want that. I have not watched the movie. I've seen pieces of it in the different trainings that I've been through. But it's just horrible. And anything we can do to prevent that, that net is going up, and that's going to help. That really, really is. I would like to see that, plus additional monies go into funding for different programs around. I think it would be wonderful.
It is still debated as to whether talking about suicide or reporting suicide in the media may encourage some people to think about it. And you would have been very aware of that when you wrote your book. And for this conversation now, when you talk about it, are you sure that we right now are not contributing to somebody thinking about killing themselves?
I don't think we are, honestly. I think we're helping to tell that person there is help and there is hope. If you can make it through the next hour, the next day, to find some help for yourself, to let someone find help for you. That's what we're looking at. Now, when we show movies like The Bridge and we dramatize something like this and showing this, then I think that raises up. And I know for a fact, after that movie, The Bridge, was shown, the suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge increased significantly. About
You would have
this,
been there at the time, right?
right? Yes.
What is it about the Golden Gate Bridge that has made it such a magnet, if you like, for suicides?
I asked a gentleman just before I retired, and he was one of the last gentlemen that I spoke to. And I asked him, he actually flew out from New Jersey. All the way from New Jersey on the other side of the United States. And I asked him, why this bridge? Why'd you fly all the way out here? And this was a very, very intelligent man, a really neat guy to talk to. But he said, it'll get the job done. And unfortunately, he did jump and it did get the job done. But I think folks think that you're just going to fly through the air and hit and you're not going to feel a thing and everything's going to be fine. And it's not that way. It can be very grotesque. It can be very brutal on a body. It is very brutal on a body. When you hit at about 75 miles an hour, and it breaks all sorts of bones. And many times when folks have hit, when they do come back up, they're flailing in the water and then they drown. Or if they do get rescued, now they suffer for the rest of their life. Sometimes they're in a wheelchair the rest of their life. So it just compounded everything that they were trying to get rid of.
I think that Joseph Stiles, who was the chief engineer, when the bridge opened back in 1937, said that it was practically suicide proof. He didn't anticipate that anybody would be able to throw themselves off that bridge. What made him so sure?
Well, and from what I read about it, is he wanted the pedestrian rails, which I believe are about 4 foot tall. He wanted those around 6 feet tall. And I think that would have done a lot. But somebody over him said at the last point when they were finalizing everything, we're going to make it smaller so people can look over the rail.
Do you cross over that bridge very often, walk over that bridge very often these days?
Since I travel a lot and I need to go to the San Francisco airport, I cross the bridge probably two, three times a month.
And do you ever see anybody on it that you worry about?
Actually, I do see it when folks, the Golden Gate Bridge Highway and Transportation District has security guards on the bridge, and I do see them when they are talking to someone, or I will see the Highway Patrol, California Highway Patrol, with them. When someone might be over the rail. So I have seen that on a couple of occasions. So we and there are trained people out there now who handle this are doing the same job that I did.
But when you started, there was no training for you, was there?
No, and it was terrible. And I say it was very much a disservice to me and the folks I was speaking to.
So people would just, you get sent out to deal with somebody who wants to kill themselves.
Exactly, just like any other call. Go handle it. But wow, don't do that to someone. Could you imagine? I mean, this is somebody's life. You wouldn't send a surgeon in untrained. I think it's the same way with this. We need to be taught active listening skills. We have empathy, of course, and I had that. But there is a skill set that we use to this and a method, and this needs to be taught and practiced and improved all the time. So it's like any other skill set. You need to go in and be taught this and practice it. So it wasn't until some time later when I went through a couple of different schools, but way towards the end of my career when I went through the Federal Bureau of Investigation Crisis Negotiator School, the FBI school, and that really, really helped. But that should have been done years ago. And I was actually one of the very, very few highway patrolmen to be able to go to this school. So I was very blessed and lucky.
How's your son now?
He's doing well. He just graduated high school and he'll be starting UC Davis, a very nice college out here by Sacramento, next month.
And that was Kevin Briggs, who is known as the guardian of Golden Gate Bridge. And we have a number of numbers on our web page. Should you need to talk to somebody about the subject of that interview or anything else, actually?